mentioned something which was perhaps implicit in my lecture, but did not mention it so explicitly, is that when you, you know, what is the Wick's theorem for fermions? So the Wick's theorem for fermions is that a time ordering product of a bunch of fermionic operators is given by the normal ordering product of the same guys and then plus all possible contractions with appropriate minus signs. So this is not a very rigorous statement. I just want to kind of get to the spirit of it. And I'll get do an example. So what I mean is that by this, suppose there are like five operators here. So say, suppose we have psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi bar 1, psi 2 bar, whereby one, or let's call this 4 and 5. And they're under time ordering. So that means that we'll have some thing like this, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4 bar, psi 5 bar. And then all the possible contractions between psi and psi bar. So there would be a contraction between psi 1 and psi 4, psi 4 bar. And the rest of the guys will be normal ordered. I'm going to, okay, let me keep the sign undetermined. And there'll be other terms, but let me look at how this term comes about. So for this to work out, you have to anti-commute psi inside the time ordering. So it goes twice to get go next to psi 4. So that it picks up a plus sign. So there should be a plus here. Once you know you've contracted it, it's a bosonic object because it's bilinear in psi and psi bar. So you can just bring this out. But the rest of the guys are still in normal ordering. And I already told you, inside the normal ordering, if you want to change the position of operators, you have to anti-commute. Because remember, we had to impose that to keep our Hamiltonian positive definite. Okay? So what is important here is that when you move, when you permute fermionic operators inside the time ordering, you pick up a minus sign. That's something that was not implicit. That was implicit in my lectures, but I didn't say it explicitly. And that has to be the case for our definition of time ordering to be consistent with the Feynman propagator. And remember that we were, so the Feynman propagator we define as the time ordering of an psi and psi bar. And we had to introduce a minus sign in the time ordering. That is, this meant that there were two cases. If say x naught is greater than y naught. But on the other hand, what I mean is that in the definition of time ordering of two fermionic operators, in the definition of time ordering, say psi A of x, psi B of y, that can, you can put a bar here or not. The definition is independent of that, so it'll, and say this is psi A of x, psi B of y, if x naught is greater than y naught, or psi B of y, with a minus sign, psi A of x, if y naught is greater than x naught. So we had to introduce this minus sign in the definition of time ordering so that our Feynman propagator, the definition of the Feynman propagator is consistent with the fact that outside the light cone, I'm running out of space, this object is zero. Okay, so today we are going to be talking about electromagnetic field. Yeah?
Can you say, like, on the commutator of two space like separated points, the two space like separated fermionic fields is zero?
Yeah.
Like, not in an expectation value or anything, just by itself.
Yeah, outside the light cone. Yeah, unless, you know, yeah, they have a delta function. But you mean, are you confused about the canonical commutation relationships, or?
Oh, sorry.
Or that was when we imposed that. You know, we said that, you know, when we impose the fact that two observers should be simultaneously measurable if they're space-like separated, and because fermionic observables are bilinear in fermions, and that can be imposed by evaluating the anticommutator, and then if the anticommutator, if they satisfy the anticommutation relationship, then the anticommutators will vanish. Yes, Ben?
So when we're contracting stuff here, do we always have to contract a psi with a psi bar?
Yeah, if you contract psi bar with psi, you get a minus sign. That's the thing.
If I contract psi bar with psi?
Yeah. And the ordering is that when you exchange the order, you pick up a minus sign.
But I would never contract a psi with a psi?
No.
Okay.
It's similar in complex scalar field theory, where, you know, you have psi psi dagger, a phi phi dagger.
Okay.
Contract. But I can contract psi with psi too. Why can't I?
Phi with phi.
Here, I can contract psi one with psi two.
No, that it's not defined. The contraction is defined. What is a contraction? It's a shorthand for the Feynman propagator, essentially.
The Feynman propagator has psi and psi bar, but what I'm saying is the time ordering of two fermionic operator, you don't care whether there are bars in there or not bars in there, they just anti-commute inside the time ordering.
There, if I contract psi 1
and
psi 5 bar,
yeah,
then I'll get a minus sign.
Right. So, you know, and then those dot terms, there will be all possible contractions, one contraction terms, and then there are all possible two contraction terms. But because I took five operators, there will be one operator left over.
Don't the contractions depend on, like, what we want out to calculate the scattering amplitude of the initial state and the final state?
The contractions,
I mean, in the Wick's theorem is independent of what in or out states we put.
If I have why I can't contract two psi's?
It's the contraction is,
when we say contract, in this context, we mean the Feynman propagator.
But then, if I contract psi There is a finite propagator defined for only scalar.
Yeah, we are not in scalar theory. We are in complex. In that case, it's not zero. But in this case, you know, this is.
If you do the 2-point, the 2-function Vick's theorem.
And
you can work this out, and you don't get any contraction for
psi. And it's similar
in complex scalar field theory. Okay.
So it is defined.
Sorry.
It is like
you can define it to be zero for just manipulation purposes. Okay.
Yeah.
But there is no such thing. If you let. Yeah. Okay. So. Today we are
going to talk about the. About the electromagnetic field and how to quantize it. So. This is the electromagnetic field is called the Maxwell field. Although I'd like to very much call it the Faraday field. So it's really the whole idea of field came from Faraday. And apparently he even tried to unify gravity. So. So first, some classical considerations. So this is the original field theory. And so we have all kind of come across Maxwell's equations at some point. And so I just cannot resist the temptation from writing them down. This is known as Faraday's law. And this is Ampere's law. And then there is Coulomb's law. And then there is the statement that there are no such thing as magnetic monopoles. So let me make some comments. These equations admit wave solutions with the wave speed of the wave is the same as the speed of light, and therefore, light is essentially electromagnetic waves. So these equations are actually covariant. But that covariance is not manifest when you write it in terms of E's and B. And the symmetry of this equation, it's covariant under the Lorentz transformation. And really, that's really what led Einstein to postulate special relativity. And they're under the absence of the current and the charge density. So this is current density, and that's charge density. The equations look remarkably, they're symmetric under the exchange of the electric field or the magnetic field. And that has inspired people to propose corrections to this equation that somewhere in the universe and magnetic charges may exist. Anyway, I won't go into that. That was one of the games that Dirac played. So let's write down the covariant form of this. So to write down the covariant form, we introduce a rank two antisymmetric tensor. So mu and nu here are tensor indices, but I'm going to write it as a matrix, 2x2 matrix now. And we arrange the electric fields as the zero I components. And the magnetic fields as the IJ components. And this is, since it's antisymmetric, there's a minus E1, here's minus E2, and there's minus E3. And here we have minus B3, and there's minus B1, and this is B2. So you can interpret mu as rho and as the rows this way, and nu's as columns. So now, if you introduce a four current, which consists of the charge density and the current density, then the equations which have sources, that is this equation and this equation, can be written in a very succinct form. Whereas the source-free equations, using the fact that mu and nu are antisymmetric, can be written as
Sorry?
How does this change if you put in magnetic monopoles? Seeing as you build them
the
up.
Definition of F, it doesn't change.
No, and then the equations?
So that equation? No, that equation is then not. Okay, so you actually get
a source term on the right. You get a source term on the right.
Okay, yeah.
You get something like this. I mean, so if your monopole current is, say, Q mu, on the right side, you'd get something like epsilon lambda mu sigma rho Q rho. I think so, you get something like that. Yeah. There might be a sign or something that is missing. Okay, so but we don't have monopoles for this class, so we are not going to consider that. I don't know who it was, but somebody noticed that there's another formulation of theory, of this theory, in terms of a vector four potential. So a vector four potential, a mu, so it's got four components. Mu goes from, so mu is 0, 1, 2, 3. And then if you define A in this way, then it takes into account the fact that F is antisymmetric and mu are nu, right? It's defined in such a way that that's obvious from the expression on the right-hand side. So now if you plug in this expression for f mu nu into the source-free Maxwell's equation, you find that the left-hand side is zero identically because of the fact that, you know, we have symmetrized over these indices. Sorry, I lied right now, so you didn't catch me. It's symmetric, right? It's anti-symmetric, actually. Sorry. It looks symmetric. You've symmetrized it, but because of the anti-symmetry of f mu nu, it is actually anti-symmetric. So sorry, scratch that. I didn't lie. Yeah.
I think maybe the thing you said about adding a term on the right-hand side seems a little iffy to me, because like the left-hand side is just always zero, right?
Well, only when you introduce a's. Before we introduce a's, the left-hand side
is zero. This is actually has physical content. This is not an identity before I introduce a. Okay? Right, okay. And when I introduce this, I can still introduce the right-hand side. What it means that the a is not a globally defined object. That, you know, there will be, you'd have to, there are patches of space-time where A has one definition, there are other patches in other with other definitions, and two patches are related by something called a gauge symmetry. Anyway, let's not go there because those are not relevant for our class. I'm happy to talk about that outside class. So, you know, when you do this, put this definition here, you can verify that left-hand side is automatically zero. So written in terms of a mu, only this equation has physical content. Or it's a dynamical equation. And that equation is the D'Alembertian acting on so that's that equation. So it turns out if you're going to quantize our theory, we have to use A's, not E's and B's. So in classical physics, the whole idea of introducing A was just a luxury. You know, you didn't have to do it. You could, but you know, it kind of made the equation look nice and stuff, but in quantum mechanics, we are forced, you know, it turns out that the field variables that we impose our commutation relationships on, they have to be A. There might be some Baroque sort of, you know, formulation of the quantum theory of electromagnetic field, which uses E's and B's, but I actually haven't come across it. But you know, people do all kinds of stuff. And you might say, why do we have to? After all, we are sci students, and we can do whatever we want. So there is something called the Bohm-Aronoff effect. And it's a Bohm who was the father of, one of the fathers of the pilot wave, theory of quantum mechanics, and Aronoff, whom you've all met. So, so the idea is that you have some electron gun. So this is some, I actually won't spend too much time on it, but, you have some screen, a double slit experiment with electrons, and behind the screen in this region is a solenoid, So this is a solenoid. It's a very long solenoid. And suppose there is no current in the solenoid, then this electron guns, when they'll make some interference pattern, you know, if you've kind of you know, depending on how coherent your electrons are, or you know, something like that. Now, if you turn on an electric field, an electric current in the solenoid, then what happens is there's a magnetic flux that goes through the solenoid, right? So B is zero everywhere in space except here. Okay? It turns out A is not zero. So if you solve this, well, what is the gauge potential for a magnetic, a very like parallel magnetic fields in a long, long solenoid in the limit that the length of the solenoid goes to infinity? You see that there is no magnetic field outside, but the electric field is non-zero. And it turns out that the interference pattern said that although the electrons don't really see a magnetic field, they actually do see the gauge potential. And the interference pattern, is changed by the introduction of this, by the fact that the A here is A mu here is non-zero. Okay? So the electron actually couples to A mu. Now it's a kind of a subtle mathematical fact that what you observe is not exactly A mu, but some twists in A mu, some topological aspects of A mu. Okay? But this is just to motivate why we need to consider A mu as our variable for quantization. Okay? So you can look up the details of the Bohm-Aronoff effect. okay.
So would that mean in turn that you can't quantize using ENB?
No, it doesn't mean that. I think probably you can using ENB. Maybe, if you have an afternoon, we can work it out. I'm sure, quantum optics people do that all the time. Because they seem to like non-covariant approach to things, so no. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, but my hunch is no, you can't. Or yeah. No, actually, you would. Yeah. Okay. Let's. Yeah. That there are more stuff. This picture is actually very similar to what you learned in GR. In GR, you learned something called curvature. And curvature is essentially, you can have some space with some curvature sort of, concentrated on that. And now if particles or photons will kind of, when they go around, they pick up, there's a trace of that in the way that, particles or spins kind of, go around curvature. This is kind of the same thing, actually. So just as in GR, we have these things called connections from which you work out the Riemann, the curvature tensors, right? So these guys, morally, it turns out, are the same things as A's. Okay. So of course, you can do an experiment. Yeah, so when you think of it in that way, it's not so, it makes a lot more sense. Anyway.
Are the same thing as the A's or the gammas?
The gammas are the same things as A's. And okay. So let's... what's a Lagrangian density for Maxwell's equations? Well, it's f mu nu, and if you write down the Euler Lagrange equation with respect to a mu, so the Euler Lagrange for a mu gives you this thing. I've not included a source here. Note that the antisymmetry of F mu nu imply that the current that you add on the right-hand side is a conserved, has to be a conserved current. Okay. So now notice two interesting things. Okay. Well, before you notice two interesting things, notice the zeroth order thing, which is the classical, you've all kind of had some course in classical electromagnetism, and it's been kind of drummed into your head that, you know, photons has two polarizations, and really the electromagnetic field has two independent degrees of freedom per unit point in at every point in space, right? And that's why, you know, we have two polarizations of photons, and that's why, you know, that's why our sunglasses work. but we, when we formulate in terms of a mu has four components, right? So it must be that there must be some kind of something hidden in there such that it cuts down those 4 degrees of freedom down to 2. And there is, first of all, because of the antisymmetry of F mu nu, because F mu nu is antisymmetric, there are no A0 dot term in the Lagrangian, okay? Well, there are no A0 dot in F mu nu, and therefore none in the Lagrangian. So we know from, you know, physics, classical physics, that whenever a variable does not have its time derivative in the Lagrangian, if you apply the Euler-Lagrange equation, you get an equation for it which is not a dynamical equation, but it should be interpreted as a constraint equation. Okay. And the constraint equation you get is this. And you can actually solve this equation. So given some initial surface where you have A and, you know, the three components of A, A1, A2, and A3, and, you know, Maxwell's equation tells you, equations tell you how they evolve, then the A0 is actually determined. So that cuts down one of the components, independent components, that A0 is really a, you know, it's a Lagrange multiplier. And number two is that if you replace your A mu in F mu nu by a different A mu, which is related to your original A mu in this way, now where it is important that alpha of x is a function of x in general, but we want alpha of x to go to 0 at spatial infinities. Okay? So alpha is a scalar function. It's not a vector. Then because partial derivatives commute, right? Then under this, if this guy is the same thing as this guy. So F mu nu does not change under this transformation. And this transformation is called a gauge transformation. There's some historic origin for this term, but it doesn't mean anything other than saying that this is the transformation. This is what a gauge transformation is. Okay. And the gauge transformation is analogous to coordinate transformations in GR. In GR, a coordinate transformation is actually a gauge transformation. So it's a local symmetry. We came across, Dan told you about how if you have a theory which has a global symmetry, that is, the parameters do not depend on space-time points, for every independent parameter, you get a conserved current and therefore a conserved charge. Here, you know, if you let alpha to be if you say, well, I'm going to take alpha global because I want to apply Noether's theorem, then you see that this term just drops out because there's a derivative. And therefore, you don't get a conserved charge from this symmetry. And if you try to derive Noether's theorem for a local symmetry, you don't get Noether's theorem. There is no conserved charge. So the gauge symmetry does not give you any new conserved charge. And two vector potentials which are related by gauge transformation like this, they give you the same F mu nu. And it's really the F mu nu that you are observing in experiments mostly. Then in all experiments, actually. No, there you do too, because you actually, you can show that the fact that A does not vanish around the solenoid tells you how the wave function of the electron shifts, but if you work it out, it actually shifts by the amount of flux which goes through the solenoid. So that somehow the twist in the A mu around the solenoid encodes how much flux, you know, there is inside.
Did you see F mu directly, or did you see A mu and then we can construct F mu?
No, we see F mu nu. We never see A mu. Yeah. Yes?
So it seems like this would give you
another yeah, it's not a physical degree of freedom. It's more kind of mathematical degree of freedom. It's not a, you know, yeah, we are not adding anything. Okay, so, right?
Where is the two constraints that you
use? Yeah, this is the second one. So we can use this freedom to fix the value of A to certain, and that gets rid of another constraint, another degree of freedom.
Okay? So choosing the gauge.
Yeah, choosing the gauge is, you are always allowed to choose a gauge, and that gets rid of another degree of freedom. Right?
Is there an overall minus sign in the F mu at the bottom?
Yes.
So,
since F mu doesn't change, this is not really this gauge transformation. You can think of it as a redundancy of description. Okay. It just, you have more ways of describing the physics than, you know, than you had previously. Yes, Jesse.
Why do we require output
at infinity?
Yeah. Because you still get the same.
Well, it actually comes from the, yeah, I know. But it actually comes from requiring F to vanish at infinity.
Okay.
And for F to vanish at infinity, you know, you have to have A vanish as infinity. And because the thing is that if alpha did not vanish at infinity,
that's because there's A prime.
Actually, I mean, you can still get pure gauge at infinity, right? But I think the pure gauge configuration actually vanishes for electromagnetism. So.
It just seems a bit stricter than what we need, because all we want is the
right, right. Yes, I agree.
Is it a
Fizeau
look at?
No, I think it's some, you know, because the light nice functions, you know, maybe it has some, you know, functional analysis for it. Let me think about it. Thank you. Okay, so so it's possible to choose the divergence of the three divergence of A to be zero,
and that leads to A, the zero component to be zero. And such a gate choice, this is a gate choice. And it goes by the name of Coulomb gauge. So in the Coulomb gauge, there are only 2 degrees of freedom left, because this is set to zero and this is constrained by this. The three other components are constrained by this one equation. But the Coulomb gauge condition, so this gauge choice condition, is not a covariant condition. A covariant condition could be the Lorentz gauge. So alternatively, we can choose something like this, and this is a covariant gauge choice. So when we choose the function on the right-hand side to be zero, so all these are Lorentz invariant gauges, because they don't change under Lorentz transformation. And when we choose this to be zero, that has a special name, called the Lorentz gauge. And no, I'm not missing a T there. It's, this Lorentz invariant gauge is named after a different Lorentz. Okay. Like almost everywhere in literature, you'll see it being called the Lorentz gauge with a T. But poor Lorentz, number two, only did this in his life, he should be remembered for it. Whereas the other Lorentz has done so many things, you know, he won't be forgotten. Okay. Yes?
Why does that imply A0 to be 0?
No, it doesn't imply. You can choose Fx to be 0.
No, I mean, the Coulomb.
Oh, so if you solve this, you can actually show this. You know, there's a, you can integrate this equation, and there's an exact form, say in David Tong's notes, or, you know, that. Okay, so which will actually give you the expression for A0, right? So you basically integrate this equation.
Right. So.
So I'd have to look into the detail of this, but you know, we can talk after class. Okay. So the Okay. One of the things is that the Lorentz gauge condition, any covariant gauge condition, does not fix the gauge completely. That's a little bit of a puzzle at this stage. So if you now it replaces A mu by another A mu up to a gauge transformation. Now, as long as you choose your function chi to be such that the D'Alembertian of chi is zero, so by D'Alembertian I mean this thing, then you'll see that the transformed A mu, which is A mu plus, you know, delta mu of chi, also satisfies the Lorentz gauge condition, right? So when we go to the Lorentz gauge does not get rid of all your degrees of freedom. And what does this really mean? It just means that the way that we have computed these degrees of freedom is a little bit more subtle. So you can think of the solution space of electromagnetism. So this is the total solution space. And suppose you have a solution, some f mu nu here. Under the gauge transformation, there's a gauge orbit in the solution space. So every point on this gauge orbit, they're physically the same. They give rise to the same f mu nu. So these are the gauge orbits. So and each line is a physically distinct solution. When we fix the gauge, what we are saying the Coulomb gauge, we are saying is that we are slicing through this space like so. So this red line is a choice of a particular gauge. It picks out a physically independent solution from each of the gauge orbits. Okay. And there could be other choices like this. I'm running out of colored chalks here. Oh no, actually there are lots more. And there could even be choices like this. This is not a good choice because, you know, it picks out the same physical, solution three times. So keeping this picture in mind, what the Lorentz gauge condition means is that we have not, there is some ambiguity in the way that we have sliced through this space of solutions. So the gauge orbit is that, suppose we have one solution, say, of the of Maxwell's equation, that is, say, due to some boundary conditions, right? And so some physical, and that solution, say, is F1. So this gauge orbit is, solution space of A mu. So that has some F1, but that F1 has associated to it some A mu. But I do a gauge transformation on that A mu. Then the F1 doesn't change, right? So, but the A changes. So what we are doing is that we are moving along this. As we do a gauge transformation, we move along this orbit. But the whole orbit represents only one F1, one solution F1. So each of these orbits represents a physically distinct solution. Okay, I won't go into, so this is kind of a cartoon to have in mind. Yes.
You have multiple solutions for F.
Yeah, the Lorentz, you know, anything that has, oh, you mean like possible examples?
Yeah, I mean, you take any, you take any sort of, you know,
okay, so
given some physical, I mean, you can work this out yourself. You given some, you know, physical F mu nu for some consideration, you know, you look up what the A mu is in some book, and, or you work out what A mu is in the Lorentz gauge. And it's a,
Actually, you know.
Yeah, so, right. Yeah, I think this is, you know, if my memory serves me correctly, if you look at the gauge potential for this guy, I think there is a gauge transformation there, which will,
you know, which
means that, you know, the two. I have to check, but I think you have to cover this with two A mu's, right? Because on a circle, you have to have some, I think you have to cover. So this is actually an example where you have to have two A mu's. That I may be wrong, but you know there are examples. I'll dig one up. Yeah, so.
So the solution space you have on the blackboard is those different orbits don't correspond to like the same configuration. They may be like totally different things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
If you take something in the Lorentz gauge and then do an arbitrary gauge transformation,
then you go out of the Lorentz gauge.
And then check that it's still in the, and then enforce that it's still in the Lorentz gauge, and then see that you actually were able to change the solution still.
But you
won't
be able to
change
the solution. If you're still in the Lorentz gauge, are you going out of the Lorentz gauge?
So the Lorentz gauge doesn't fully constrain what your solution looks like, right?
A mu doesn't look like it. Doesn't control.
So if you take A mu that's in the Lorentz gauge and then do an arbitrary gauge transformation, except then you enforce that you make alphas such that you enforce that you're still in the Lorentz gauge.
Yeah.
And there's some residual freedom of what alpha can be. I think it looks like it will need to be harmonic or something. Then that shows that you can make gauge transformations that keep you in the Lorentz gauge.
Right.
So that's an example of.
Yeah. It's just I couldn't come up with a
real world physical example. You know.
The thing that confused me is that I thought that those were like different solutions for like same physical problem.
Yeah, the gauge orbits are.
The gauge orbits. Yeah. Sure. But like different orbits correspond to same. No.
Really different.
cool. Yeah, that's what confused me.
You know, in fact, in path integrals, it's not invisible. It's not possible. You know, in path integrals, you actually have this space where you integrate over all these things. You know, they don't have to be solutions of the natural solution. Anyway, I want to carry on and
do the real quantization stuff. But I'm going to take one last question from Ryan.
So, cool gauge satisfies the Lorentz.
No.
Well, you know, I mean, if you make a general
gauge transformation, you go out of the Coulomb gauge, right?
The spatial part of A is divergence free.
Yeah, I mean, if you make a general gauge transformation, you're no longer in the Coulomb gauge, right? Okay, quantization. So.
You know, David Tong, in his lecture notes, does the Coulomb gauge quantization, and that's a very nice quantization choice of doing quantization because you don't have any unphysical degrees of freedom. all the gauge freedom has been eliminated, and you know, everything is fine except you don't have covariance, right? So because you know we like discussions that I like to confuse students, we are going to quantize in a covariant gauge. It's much more fun. And also, we are going to apply this to QED, and QED is, as done in high energy physics, is always done in a context which is covariant. So in the Lorentz gauge, and now that I have said that I shouldn't use the T, I have to make sure I don't actually. So in the Lorentz gauge, which I remind you what it is, our equation, Maxwell's equation in vacuum, it looks like this. And we are lucky this just looks like a set of four Klein-Gordon equations with mass set to zero, right? So immediately we know that classically, well, this is a very nice linear equation. We can expand in terms of Fourier modes. And although none of the book seems to be using this convention, I'm going to use the convention that for the rest of the course. So I introduce four polarization vectors. Now I'm going to call them 0, 1, 2, 3, label them 0, 1, 2, 3. And you'll see at some point why. But you know, I could have called them whatever, Alice, Bob, Charles, Eve. And then there are the Fourier coefficients, which when we quantize will become annihilation operators. And because a mu, we take a mu to be real, although you know when you study circularly polarized lights, you can consider complex a mu's. Then, you know, we have the same guy here, and then we have a dagger. Also, I could have taken this to be the complex conjugate of this. Okay. Well, the dagger, by dagger, I mean star at this point. Okay. Now, these E's, these polarization vectors, the lambda is the label for the which polarization vector I'm looking at, and mu is the component. So in the Lorentz gauge, you know, this means that E lambda satisfy this, you know, for all p's. So on physical grounds, we expect two of these polarizations to be orthogonal to the direction of the propagation. So if p is our three momentum, we expect this, Let's write E1 to have this form, and E2 to be of this form. And then if P is the direction of propagation, well, the three momentum of the photon of the field, then E1 or E2 this is zero. But we still have for the other E's, we can have them being proportional to the P mu, because since we're dealing with a massless scalar, a massless field, the fact that the momentum squares, the four momentum squares to one, mean that if the E is proportional to P mu, that this condition is still satisfied. So there is the possibility that the polarization vector will have components which are either has components in the time direction or in the direction which is parallel to the propagation of light. So one can use the gauge freedom to eliminate these extra degrees of freedom. But it turns out that when we quantize our theory, this equation itself is problematic. That this equation does not make sense quantum mechanically. We'll see that soon. And therefore, for now, we're going to carry around with us all four components of the polarization vector. Okay? And then we'll see that how to impose this quantum mechanically is a very subtle thing, and we'll do so. Okay? So for now, we are just going to carry on all four possible polarization components. Yeah?
Direction of the propagation being parallel to.
Oh, right. So if I choose, there are four components in principle, for example, we can choose a reference frame where, say, it's the wave, it's plane wave going along the z direction. Then I can choose a polarization which is proportional to P. And we are still in the Lorentz gauge because, this condition is still satisfied because the four vector P squares to zero, right? Because it's null, right? And the fact that, Now, because we have four, polarization vectors, we should impose some conditions on them, and let's choose them to be orthogonal. So let's choose them to be orthogonal. So we have some lambda. And we choose the orthogonality condition to be covariant. So here, this is something that looks like the Minkowski metric, but what it is saying is that we are imposing, so it's kind of a, it's a covariant orthogonality condition, if you like. And then we also have some normalization condition, and the normalization condition is E mu, this is a vector, so I can always raise the index here, and this will be, so this is our normalization condition. Also, it can, it's a covariant normalization condition. See that the zeroth component of the epsilon tensor squares to minus one, sorry, plus one, whereas the spatial components square to minus one. So when P is of this form, we can we can choose, say, E0 to be something like this, and E3 to be something like this. this is called the time-like polarization, just names. Time-like, or sometimes called the scalar photon or polarization. And this one is called the longitudinal. Because this is parallel to the direction of propagation. Okay, now let's see why we have problem with quantization and in the Lorentz gauge. And the first, notice that our equation does, this equation does not follow from the Lagrangian we wrote down over there. Yeah?
Then in what we are writing now, we still have freedom to choose.
So the direction of propagation is given by some physical boundary condition or things like that. Say, let's just say, you have some plane wave, and then, you have some well-defined direction of propagation for the photons, right?
And the thing is that I'm still talking kind of classically there. So, I'm actually being very vague here. I mean. Why did we, we are choosing these guys so that they, they satisfy these conditions. Okay? And if you think of a configuration of your electromagnetic field, which is propagating in the z direction, then this would have the interpretation of being longitudinal. Okay? But if your direction of propagation is in the x direction, then this would actually not be longitudinal. That would be transverse. Okay? Thank you. So this does not follow from the Maxwell-Lagrangian. Because this is a gauge fixed equation. So what we do is that we add a term to our electromagnetic Lagrangian, and the term which we call a gauge fixing Lagrangian. And to derive this equation, the gauge fixing Lagrangian that we choose, that we add, is simply okay. So there's actually a bit of subtlety here. Okay, we are trying to derive an equation that looks like the same equation that you would get if you took the equation of electromagnetism and imposed the Lorentz gauge. Okay. Now, if you work this out, you know, up to total derivative terms, so, you know, by integration by parts, you can work this out to be this is the Lagrangian that we are using. Last year when Freddie taught this course, he quantized this theory and he said we are quantizing the non-Maxwell theory, okay? Because this Lagrangian that you're working with is a gauge-fixed Lagrangian. It's not the original Lagrangian. But this gauge-fixing, whenever you have got gauge theories and you're quantizing it, you will always have to use a gauge-fixing Lagrangian. There's really, yeah?
So we are able to add this term to the Lagrangian only because we have imposed the condition that
we have not imposed the condition.
We want to get this equation, which looks like the same equation that we get from here, if we are in the Lorentz gauge. So given that this is our Lagrangian, L prime, there is no gauge freedom. It's not a gauge invariant Lagrangian, right? I mean, this is not gauge invariant. Because we want to quantize an equation that looks like.
We are still in the same theory.
Possibly we're not. And quantum mechanically, you know.
This is the theory that we quantize. We don't quantize, you know. The thing is, there's a caveat or qualification, I should say. If you were to quantize a theory in a different gauge, the physical result you would get would be equivalent to this. And that is basically how we know that we're in the same theory, although we have quantized them differently. Okay. I think Perseus had a question first. No. Exactly. Yeah, they're not total. It's not a total derivative term. Ben? Was it you who had a question?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't know if my question is really distinct. It's not sitting easy with me. I mean, you said that this is not classically the same theory. I mean, if we write down this Lagrangian before we quantize or anything, can we get anything looking like electromagnetism out of it, or is this like just?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't done the classical theory of L prime. Maybe there is.
So.
It's not a gauge invariant theory. So.
Right, but will we get, I know maybe you don't have the answer to it, but if we were to, you know, do the
classical
or Lagrange equations and everything out of there, would this be equivalent to?
Right, yeah, I mean, look at that. You know, it just looks like a
set of four massless scalar fields. It has some S, you can think of it as a theory which has a global SO1,3 invariance, right? Sorry?
Can we get electro E and B fields out of it from like?
You'll get something. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move on. We are running out of time. I have to quantize in the next 10 minutes. But what's nice, why did I do this? I did this because remember that the Maxwell Lagrangian did not have a zero dot. Therefore, the pi zero for the Maxwell case did not exist. So the momentum conjugate to a zero did not exist, and therefore we could not impose a covariant quantization condition. Now that we have added this term, gauge fixing term, now a zero dot exists. It's in our Lagrangian. And in our L prime theory, this very glamorously called L prime theory, the canonically conjugate momentum fields are just given by minus of a mu dot. So now we impose the conditions that we usually impose for quantization. And I'm just going to go directly to the Heisenberg frame and write them as equal time commutation relationships. So this is 0. The pi similarly is 0. And what we have here is the a mu of x, a mu of 3x t a nu dot of x prime of t has a minus I here from this minus sign. And there's an I here. But now, because we want to do a covariant game, we are forced to introduce the Minkowski metric over here. And let me raise this so you can see it. So those are the quantization conditions that we impose, okay?
So those are specifically not, are those really covariant if you've got a delta 3 rather than delta 4?
Sorry?
Are those really covariant if you've got a delta 3 rather than a delta 4?
Because we are doing Hamiltonian quantization, that's why we have got delta 3. But the Hamiltonian quantization is covariant, but not manifestly covariant. Because the Hamiltonian is not a covariant object. It is not an invariant object. Okay. Right. So then you can do the usual thing that you do and work out what the commutation relationships are between the creation and the annihilation operators, A's and A daggers. And you find something very shocking. Okay, you have A lambda. I'm just gonna drop, I'll just keep until I forget. Thank you. There's a minus sign here. There's an eta here, and there's a lambda lambda prime here. And there's a delta cubed k minus k prime. OK, with all the other commutators vanishing. So immediately you're going to say, hang on, there's something terribly wrong here. Because if I create a one particle state using the A0 guy, then let's call this, say, phi. So A0 with some momentum, say, k. Then you get a minus eta 0, 0.
Tigger, you said a Brari Google cat.
It's that time of the day. Is this notation? So you get 2 pi cubed, some delta of 0. And our time is plus, right? So yeah, you basically get a term with a negative note. Bad news.
I mean, it's only if you want a physical interpretation.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you're like, it's obvious where this guy's coming from. This guy's coming from the fact that we carried around all these polarizations, unphysical polarizations. And we did not dare to impose, Lorentz gauge condition as an operator equation, and I can see Dylan's hand going up there.
I just wanted to ask what the problem was.
There's a minus sign there. We cannot interpret this as a norm of a state. So we are not in what mathematicians call a Hilbert space.
Are we worried about delta 0?
Oh, you know, this you can always... No, I'm not worried about delta 0 because, you know, these are, you can always integrate over some nice, wave packet and deal with that delta 0. But the negative sign is the one that worries us. Okay. So why did we not impose the Lorentz gauge condition? And the reason is that, so if you calculate what a mu x and a nu y is, and let's give it a name, say d mu nu x minus y, and I haven't checked the conventions, but up to some sine, this is the same thing as what you got for the free scalar theory, but with the mass going to 0 of phi x and phi y. You get the same function. That's what I mean. Now, if you impose, this function is not 0. Was not 0 in general for the free scalar theory. It was 0 outside the light cone and all that, but in general, it's not 0. Now, if you impose this, then the left hand, so you're taking the derivative with respect to x here. The left-hand side goes to 0, the right-hand side doesn't. Okay? You're in trouble. That's one reason why, that's like just to illustrate why we cannot impose this as an operator equation. So two guys Gupta and Bleuler figured out a way out of this. Because I'm in my last 2 minutes, I'm going to use the fourth board. They said, hey, what if we, it's a little bit like saying that, you know, I don't think they used that argument, but okay. What if instead of imposing that as an operator equation, we use it as a constraint on the state of space? What is the weakest thing that we can use and get away with it? So if you take the A plus component of A mu, so this is the one, this is the part of the A mu expansion which creates the annihilation operator. So it's this bit. This is what I'm calling A mu plus. They said, we are only going to look at those states in our state space which are annihilated by this guy. Any state in our theory which does not satisfy this condition, we're just going to throw away. So this is, in some sense, the states are the physical states. So then if you take the conjugate of this and then add the two things together to these two equations, then on those physical states, you get this, right? Because the conjugate of this is there's a minus here, right? And this, they said, is the, this is how we impose, you know, the Lorentz gauge, is by this weak, weak condition. Okay. Sorry? No, so you're just adding these. So this A mu is A mu plus A mu minus. So I should write down the name of these guys, Gupta and Bleuler. So this is the Gupta-Bleuler condition.
And your big size is a vacuum, right?
No, any state. The vacuum is included, but any state. Yeah?
What I'm saying is that when you take the product of the two stuff you wrote there, you're supposed to get a product and not.
Oh, I see. Okay, right. You're saying this acting on this?
Yes. And taking the conjugate. Why are we just having A mu there? Where you've written the simplification to be with a positive sign.
Right. Okay. Okay. I think this is what I meant. So the derivative only acts on this, and then you get an expression. So if you take A mu plus is this first part, and you take the derivative, so that brings out P, and that's what I mean, okay? So it's not acting on your state. Sorry, yeah, I should have been more clear. So this is the Gupta-Bleuler condition. And I won't be able to finish this today, but I will show in the next time that we are doing a free theory, of course, for the Hamiltonian, for example, it means that, it relates the K It relates the longitudinal and the time-like components of your state in such a way that their contribution to physical quantities cancel out. So the Hamiltonian is only in the Hamiltonian when you apply the Hamiltonian on a say on a on a state which satisfies the Gluck-Tibler condition, it gives you positive definite states. And let me just okay. So I'm just gonna come back to this next time. So if we choose our polarizations to be and we have, say, I should read this. E1 of mu is, say, 0. It's this components, which are, and when our P is okay. If you do this, then the condition means the third component of the annihilation operator minus the zeroth component. Hi, Don.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. But this thing is zero. And let's finish there. Thank you. So I'll come back to this next at the beginning of next class, okay? Before they write it down, just erase it. Oh yeah, you can do that. Yeah. I'm just messing with you. Oh, sorry, yeah. I'll write that again next time.